Welcome to the Sum of It All Universal Design for Learning podcast. I'm Audrey Mendeville, along with my colleague Mark Alcorn from the San Diego County Office of Education. And this season, we're exploring the third edition of UDL Now, a teacher's guide to applying universal design for learning by Katie Novak. Transcripts for our podcast are always available for you in the episode notes on your favorite platform. This episode, we're chatting about chapter five, the power of expert learning.
Yeah, Audrey, let's just start with that title for a second. Let's hang out there for a moment.
Yeah.
The power of expert learning. And what I'd like to do as we dive into this discussion, how about we just add a couple more words to the end? So how about we do it like this? The power of expert learning in mathematics.
Yeah, I would love to focus on that. So if we unpack this idea of expert learners, what does it mean to be an expert? What does it mean to be like an expert learner? Katie describes it this way and says expert learners are motivated, they're purposeful, they're resourceful, they're knowledgeable, they're strategic, and they are goal-directed.
Yeah, good summary. And it seems as you're saying those things, Audrey, that it seems that self-awareness, it just seems like it's a big part of it. You know, self-awareness from the point of view of the student. As a student, I know what barriers are helpful for me to lower, which will help me learn. And I also am aware of the assets I'm bringing to the table that I can use to take advantage of my learning, right?
Right. So Katie starts off this article or this chapter with a Forbes article that she quotes that says, what should 21st century learning look like? So if expert learning is what you're describing and we're talking about here, what should the situations look like? And they describe it as personal and personalized, purposeful, honors learner variability, but that it combines skill sprints and extended challenges, learner voice and choice, et cetera, et cetera. I struggled with some of those, Mark. I'm not really sure that I agree fully with their list, and maybe it's slightly out of date by this point in time, as we are starting to march our way through the 21st century. But I also think this idea of portrait of a graduate that they talk about and the graduate profile connection, you know, these are things that are happening in our region. Districts are sitting down and they're saying like, what is it that we want our graduate profile to look like? What is it? What are the things, what are the nitty gritty pieces of this lifelong learner that we have listed in our mission statement that we're trying to support? Or what does it really mean to prepare our students to be ready for the success in the world as it is now? And so I think each time we kind of get into the details of what it is that really means that we'll look up and we will say we have done a good job with the time we've had with these students. We've really helped prepare them and for them to look at themselves and say like, I'm ready for this next thing. Like, what does that look and sound like? And I think all of those pieces are kind of going towards this idea of expert learner in this chapter.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, Audrey, I think in the past, historically, we've done a pretty poor job of kind of forecasting what we want our expert learners to look and sound like for as they engage in mathematics. As they become expert learners in mathematics, what should that look and sound like? As I'm thinking of that right now, I think a lot of times we'd be like, we want you to be ready to do calculus. You know, like it was all sort of about like, we need to get you ready for a particular course or for college in mathematics. It wasn't so much about how do you become an expert learner in mathematics. And I think the thing that's really encouraging over the last 10, 12 years around that is with our Common Core standards, as you know, we have content standards, but we also have practice standards. And these standards for mathematical practice, or SMPs, as we call them, they have a lot of insight around what we want that expert learner to be in mathematics. Some of the practices are make sense of problems and persevere in solving them. That word persevere is almost like it came right out of the UDL guidelines, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another one that I think is just wonderfully written is use appropriate tools strategically. They used four words to describe so much with that practice. Use appropriate tools. There's decision-making. We've been talking about decision-making in mathematics and in UDL, right?
Mm-hmm.
Strategically, I'm using that tool to help myself learn. I know myself as a learner, and that is something I can take advantage of. And the other resource that came to mind, Audrey, while you're talking is Tracy Zager's Becoming the Math Teacher That You Wish You Had, which is a big shout out for that resource. Her chapter titles of that book are behaviors that mathematicians engage in. Things like mathematicians take risks. Mathematicians are precise. They use intuition. They reason. They prove. And Audrey, I can't help but think about when we talk about expert learners in mathematics, those are some of the things that I think we need to put into the mix as we examine how UDL helps us do that better.
Yeah, I really appreciate that connection, Mark. Those two connections, actually, like that if we're seeking to define expert learning in mathematics, those SMPs have to be part of our definition, right? Those are the habits that our students are engaging in if they are expert learners of mathematics. And similarly, those titles that Tracy's book has, that when our students are engaging in this way, they are engaging as mathematicians. They are expert learners of mathematics. And so I really appreciate you taking time to consider those. And such a great point. I think both of those push on the idea, though, that our students have to be thinking and not mimicking, which has been our problematic stance in the education and the learning of mathematics for many, many years.
Yeah, it's a great point, Audrey. And it really brings me back to our discussion last week with chapter four. And I just think it's really important to just point out again that we're creating expert learners in problem solving and critical thinking. We're not creating expert learners in mimicking computation that the teachers had demonstrated. And by the way, we also want you to do that very quickly.
Right,
So,
speed. Yeah.
And it really goes back to this, Audrey, like that notion that teachers are the sole source of knowledge in mathematics. Like that in and of itself, if that's the stance we have when we get in front of students in our classrooms, it's a false setup because it actually discourages in any kind of critical thinking or creativity to take place. I think back to middle school when I was in middle school, I had this one teacher, a couple of kids would sometimes raise their hand and say, "You know, I have another way of thinking about that." And man, he shut that down so fast. That was like, "Do not move this train off the track. We are going somewhere and we do not need any interruptions, right?"
Yeah, I think you and I had the same math teacher then, Mark, because I experienced the same thing. I think that's a great question. Like, what should then creativity and innovation look like and sound like in mathematics, right? It doesn't exist in the time and space of do as I did, copy this example, and now rinse and repeat with the next example, right? Like, creativity and innovation happens in the, well, how else could you see it? And getting unexpected answers and unexpected ideas out of students and having them share the way that they are viewing the problem with all of the brilliance and their cultural competence, you know, that they're bringing to the situation, everything that they've lived experience, that's it's all going to come out in those moments. And so we have to make time and space for that, which makes me think we have to go back and talk about how this all relates to the kind of tasks we stick in front of our kids to engage in, that we have to have the right things in front of them in order to allow the space for them to be creative and innovative in mathematics.
Yeah, great way to say it. And you know what? I'm looking right now as you spoke about those two words, creativity, innovation. Those are not words that traditionally we've heard in mathematics classrooms. And those are unlikely to happen in that environment of mimicking. To answer the question involves posing tasks to students that don't have required solution paths. So we're talking about what is the answer? The answer is that we pose tasks that don't have a particular solution path that is required and allow them, as you said, share their brilliance, share the creativity that they have around coming up with a particular solution strategy that is unique.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, Mark. I think you've hit right on there about what we need to be thinking about as we engage our students in creativity and innovation. You know, in this chapter, there is a section on essential next generation skills, and there's some domains there. And I just want to point out for a second around kind of the problematic centering of this idea of core subjects and skills. And I'd like to just take a moment about that. You know, I've read some other stuff from other great folks that talk sometimes about this idea of like, we have it as a teacher of mathematics, whether you're doing this in elementary, but certainly if you're doing this in secondary, we have a seat of like privilege that kids have to take our classes. Someone at some point in time decided that these are really important for graduation and everyone has to take them and they're important for the next steps in life. So you have to take them. And so kids are forced into our seats. If our classes were electives, I'm not sure kids would still sign up for them. And
Ha
And I have to wonder often, right? What would happen, if we had to go out and sell our class to a group of
Oh,
students? It wouldn't happen, would it? Our
no.
sections would be shut down. So, I wonder sometimes about this idea of is it driven by a need for numeracy or being able to think
No.
mathematically, like you were talking about with the practices? Or perhaps are we putting this idea here as a core subject in something that's maybe rooted in hundreds of years of practice? And so it might be interesting to debate at some point in time, and maybe not today on the podcast, but whether or not numeracy is any more important than artistry or philosophical thinking or scientific understanding or even just generally curiosity.
Wonderful points, Audrey. I think we've had this reading and math core subject piece just retreaded with standardized testing in a variety of things. And I think that word core can be really dangerous and problematic. And I think we really should really use it with caution, because I can't even imagine what our world would be like if it was just about reading and writing and math, and we took away all of those very, very essential things that are part of who we are to make us human. And I think we just have to really make sure that we're including all content areas when we get into subjects of what is core.
Yeah, fantastic point. I love that about what it means to be human. It's certainly not limited to those two things. But so, further, if I'm going to push just a little further on this issue, of all the things that are important to mathematics, I'm also curious about how numeracy keeps getting pushed to the forefront. Like, why not patterning? Why not spatial reasoning? Why not logical reasoning? I'm stuck on this bit a little bit about how numeracy keeps getting pushed higher and higher in importance. And I'm not trying to dismiss numeracy. I think it's important. I'm not like, don't hear me wrong, listeners. Like, I'm not anti numbers or making sense of numbers. But
Right.
I don't believe it's the kind of the sole provider of all mathematical engagement and thinking.
Yeah, boy, we have inherited such a narrow lane of mathematics. And I was doing some reading around spatial reasoning, and I found out that even historically, it wasn't the case in early times. There was a lot of mixture of science and math, and spatial reasoning and other types of mathematics was very embedded into learning things around science. And I think that a lot of what we've inherited is post Industrial Revolution view of what math do we need to give people for them to be productive citizens. But the problem is we never went back to check to see if that changed.
Yeah.
In other words, doing large amounts of computation by hand, that may have served a group of people that might have been purposeful for them in professions at one time in history, like in the early to mid 1900s. But newsflash, there are no jobs waiting for our students that can do long division fast.
Yeah. And I'm probably going to push a hot button, not even to recite their multiplication tables fast. So just, I would caution us for putting it too high up the list of priorities. Further in the chapter, there's a little bit of this idea of a content expert versus an expert learner. And Katie talks about how there's this need in this core subjects and skills section for our teachers to be content area experts. And math is definitely not immune to that mantra. I've heard it in all kinds of spaces, like our teachers just don't know the content well enough. They're not experts. I'm sure you've heard this in the elementary spaces. I've heard it many, many times said about elementary teachers and specific to mathematics. But I've heard it also for secondary teachers, like they don't really know the math. And I think content expertise is important, but I think we hold it to a higher expectation and then also kind of make it as an excuse for why things don't happen, instead of really thinking about the stance of being an expert learner as a teacher and modeling that for as a teacher. I've heard folks say, well, the reason our students didn't get that, our teachers aren't content experts. If they just knew more about content, it would all be fixed. And maybe there's some merit there, but I think that we have to be very careful about how we label people with this deficit I mindset almost around them, that they're not good enough because they don't know enough content. And we wield it around as excuse for why student performance is the way it is or why scores are the way they are. And I really think that when teachers hold a stance as an expert learner, when they model that, when they're transparent about that, that content knowledge might be less important. That their stance is saying, like, I'm going to be the learner here. I'm going to continue to learn. I'm going to ask questions. We're going to seek to understand that maybe that could overshadow any perceived deficit in content knowledge that they have.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. It definitely rings true with me in working in elementary grades around this idea of, you know, we have teachers teaching many different content areas, and they're going to have variability regarding their depth of knowledge in any one of those content areas. But I definitely have heard many times around this notion of elementary teachers having math is not sort of their main jam, right? But I really appreciate your point that you're mentioning here is that if I'm a teacher and I'm going to take an elementary teacher, let's just say for example, and I'm going to believe that I'm also an expert learner, that should not be a barrier, especially if my instruction is not reinforcing that I'm the expert
Right.
and I am the keeper of all mathematics and I am here to deliver it to you. I think that traditional notion of the expert in mathematics has retreaded that whole notion that you need to be the expert because you have to be up there explaining things exactly correctly. And so there's an added pressure, I think, that's kind of retreaded itself.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think the flip side is particularly dangerous as well. I think when you have teachers that have a deep content knowledge, but they do not position themselves as expert learners, it is just as problematic. And it
True.
pushes back into that stand and deliver, I am the expert space. So that's those two sides are there. So I think at the end of the day, I would just caution us from holding content knowledge on a higher pedestal for our teachers than encouraging them to have a stance as an expert learner. There will always be more math understanding and learning to be had. And so, like, if we don't look at it as an end point that we can reach, but as something that's continually growing, then perhaps we can hold that stance as a learner a little better.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Let's move on to the next section in the chapter, Audrey. There is a section called Learning and Innovation Skills. And you know, there was a phrase in the chapter in this section that kind of made me start thinking about how I'm thinking about wording. And it said something like learning how to learn, right? Which, yeah, that makes sense to me. But I started thinking about in mathematics, learning how to learn in mathematics. And then I wondered a little bit about playing around with the wording and saying, is it learning how to make meaning of mathematics? Like, is it learning how to learn in mathematics, or is it learning how to make meaning of mathematics?
You know, that's an interesting change there, Mark. I'll admit there's probably quite a bit of baggage around the idea of learning mathematics. That feels passive. It feels like I'm sitting there and someone is doing the teaching to me. And part of that's probably just my own schema around like sitting in the room and the experiences I had when I was supposedly learning mathematics, it being so very passive instead of active.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I think that's probably what's happening when I'm seeing that because I think the way I said the two statements, they have like subtle differences. Like learning how to learn could still mean that I'm looking for better ways to understand what my teacher is telling me when they're lecturing at me, and I need to mimic it. Versus where learning how to make meaning of math concepts, I guess the thing that comes to mind is I kind of change the wording a little bit. It nudges me to consider how engaging in the Standards for Mathematical Practice, the SMPs, might help me make meaning of the mathematics. It's back to use appropriate tools strategically, one of the practice number five. It's like I'm in the driver's seat. I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to be doing learning, but it's in service of my decision making and what makes sense to me. One of the things that you and I have done in the past that we should mention, Audrey, is we've taken the UDL guidelines and the Standards for Mathematical Practice and look to see which places we've seen overlap in those two things. For example, I'm looking at the comprehension under the representation principle, provide options for comprehension. And again, that idea of using tools strategically, which can help me have a better visualization of the mathematics. And I'm seeing this guide information processing and visualization. That's one of the checkpoints, right? So like that idea of me using tools strategically is going to help me access that particular checkpoint in my standards for mathematical practice. So I encourage our listeners to take those S&Ps and take the UDL guidelines, look for those overlaps, because I think the overlaps just look for, those allow us to see where we have places for higher leverage, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So this section on learning innovation skills had some interesting ideas around how you might change things up in your classroom from a reading assignment to something else. And I think Katie is setting us up so well for the next chapter, which is around goals.
Right.
Because she gave an example here that is absent of a goal and went back to the old school way of doing things in terms of like, I'm going to teach them something to read and something to write, you know, but I don't really have a goal. And all of a sudden it becomes a science lesson, but not really. And that's where I think we just have to be super, super careful. It's like we often take some shortcuts and we get right into doing things and we're spending all of our time doing things, but not in service of anything. And so, you know, I know if my colleagues who sit on, you know, the science world read this, they would look up and say, this is not students engaging in science. This is students engaging in reading about scientific ideas. And so like the same thing happens in math. I think we spend a lot of times with students sitting on the outside reading about how other people were creative in mathematics and check out this amazing thing I want you to learn about how someone before was innovative in mathematics, instead of allowing the students to be really the innovators and the creators of the mathematics. And so another push there around how goals is so important to that. And again, another plug for us to get to that next chapter to read it. So
It's coming up, Audrey. It's coming up. Well, hey, let's jump into this next section of this chapter. It's career and life schools. Life skills. And I'm sorry, Audrey, I got to bring a couple of people that live in my house into this mix here. So, you know, I have twins and they are high school seniors, right? Mm-hmm. And so let me just tell you, throughout the years, we've had many conversations over schooling. Mm-hmm. And I've done reflecting about me as a former fifth grade teacher. And as I listen to my students who are the recipients of our educational process, is I think sometimes it's interesting how We really love to give the speech about schools getting you ready for careers, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't that a big speech? Like, we say things like around homework, right? You must do homework this way and you could never be late on your homework. I'm docking you all kinds of points because that helps you build responsibility. And that's what it's going to be like in the real world. And then in the real world, you ask your supervisor for an extension of your deadline because that makes perfect sense in the moment. So, and then my daughter actually recently mentioned another one where she's got a notebook where she's got a whole bunch of bathroom passes and she has to be very strategic about when she uses them as a high school student versus as an adult at work. I think when we need to use the bathroom, that's where we're headed.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a fair pushback by her, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm not immune to this either with my children. I was just at back to school night this last week for my middle schooler, and three of the five teachers talked about how they were preparing them for high school, you know, as sixth graders. And so we get into this like momentum thing of like, we're preparing them for the next thing. We're preparing them for the next thing.
Yeah.
But if we paused for a minute, like if we went back just even 12 years when your kiddos were in kindergarten, right?
Oh, wow.
And we asked them, how can I prepare you to be a social media manager? Like that job didn't exist, right? And yet your kids could walk out the door at the end of the year and become that. And yet, did we do anything in the 12 years to prepare them for that? And so like, we're trying to prepare our kids for the future as if the future exists now.
Right.
And we need to prepare our kids for the future that exists when they get there. Does that make sense? Like we're doing it backwards, and we're trying to limit it so much into like what we know instead of broadening it and saying like, I need to prepare you for all kinds of possibilities that are beyond what I can even imagine in this moment that will be there in the 2 years when you graduate, in the 12 years when you graduate, whatever, you know, age group you're working with.
Yeah, great point. And you know, as you're talking, one of those broad areas, I think, which Katie brings out, is this idea of collaboration, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's one of the true ones. Unlike some of the stuff we say about homework, I think collaboration has huge leverage, right? Like it's something that's something that we can work on with teamwork and collaboration. And I think that it's worth revisiting season one again, Peter Liljedahl's book, Thinking Classrooms. And Boy, that book is just filled with lots of stuff to talk about with collaboration. But I'm going to just pull out one thing because otherwise we'll turn into an episode of episode, season one. Visibly random groupings. I just want to throw that out there, Audrey, as something to consider as we look for expert learning happening within collaboration. And just really the idea of our students frequently being mixed into randomized groupings and what that can do for our students in terms of their variability, in terms of like them being able to work with many different types of learners and them becoming an expert learner about working with many different people. And one last thing I'll say about that that I think is so critical is that it allows us to appreciate each other in terms of our variability. So in other words, when I'm working with all the students in my classroom throughout the course of a few months, I can truly appreciate what variability is all about and how all the different students that I have in my class have so many gifts and brilliance.
Yeah. And what a great space then to become an expert learner, like you described, about learning about myself and how I need to continue to learn, to grow, and work with different people. You know, this idea of collaboration is one that I could talk endlessly on as well. Like, there are so many things to think about with collaboration. And I think you're getting at the heart of like what this is really about, in terms of helping students learn to collaborate. Part of what the question always goes back to for me is this idea of task. Like, is it worth collaborating on? Like, do we need to collaborate on it? You know, like my boss gives me an assignment, and sometimes I'm like, I got this. And other times I turn and I say, let me pull a couple of friends and let's work together, right? And knowing which case it is an important expert learner move, right? And so, how do we give our kids either autonomy for that or teach into that so that they can see, like, this is why it is necessary to collaborate with people in this moment?
Fantastic point. As we're wrapping up this episode, Audrey, I just a couple of thoughts that I'm thinking as we're kind of wrapping up is I just think that something that's really on my mind is as adults in mathematics, teaching mathematics, we just have to get out of the way. I think back to the way I learned mathematics by sitting quietly and listening to teacher, definitely not raising my hand for a new way to think about it. And I think I'm hardwired to replicate that. And it's good for me to recognize that, right? So when I started teaching mathematics to elementary students, you know what I was left with needing to do is I had to be an entertainer. I had to come up with really interesting, fun ways to sort of dress up the thing that didn't seem so interesting. It was important to keep them, quote unquote, paying attention, right? So since that time, I've really worked to break that cycle. Where I need to be the sole mathematical authority in the classroom. And I just truly believe our students will not become expert learners if everything we do is supporting them in becoming expert mimickers.
Yeah, you're right. Like they're not going to be get there if we don't change things. So the maybe the best thing we can offer in this moment is if we are expert learners as teachers, as leaders, with transparency, with modeling that we're making decisions that build upon our own strengths to overcome barriers that are in our way, to reconsider our assets in those moments, that those are the ways that we continue to grow and maybe approach the teaching of students in mathematics to feel the same way.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for joining us in this episode. We are really looking forward to our next episode about Chapter 6, Firm Goals and UDL Implementation. Until then, send us a tweet, the hashtag SumMathChat. That's #SumMathChat with your questions and thoughts. We'll keep the conversation going there. Until then, best wishes on rethinking our practices.